Well, Amazon, right? I mean, it's such a friggin' nightmare. Where do you begin, right? They proved after their reaction to John Oliver's segment the other day that they continue not to have a sense of humor. But it also revealed all the stuff that we kind of know. You have the richest man in the world, despite his personally embarrassing divorce. Despite that, he's the richest man in the world. And he makes his money off of workers who are paid relatively low wages for the most part, contingent employment, backbreaking work. If you want the most recent testimony on that, just go to John Oliver's site. It was all about warehouse work in general in this country, but specifically on Amazon, it's very good. But that's just kind of the beginning of discussing, the Amazon nightmare in this country. There was a two-year race to the bottom for the cities to outbid themselves to provide Amazon with subsidies, tax breaks, serfs, whatever, to create their new second headquarters, which they after playing a bit of a shell game, decided to put in Northern Virginia, which lo and behold, was later revealed that it's to deepen their relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. Amazon's image over the last few years is certainly not one that shines as bright as it once did. I mean, it's, within our living lives, but actually within the last 5 years, that all of the tech giants have been gone from being seen as, saviors of humanity and the planet. I mean, remember when Mark Zuckerberg was supposed to save the planet, and Steve Jobs, and Jeff Bezos? And now they're all seen as corporate criminals, living off of the public treasury, and all being led by people who are kind of weird. When Bezos was asked, what do you plan to do with your fortune? He said he thought about it and gave his, pre-discussed answer. He said, mostly space travel. Most of us think about, co-pays, paying the rent, but Jeff has greater ambitions for his money. At the same time, this is all going on, is that I don't want to say that Amazon is a company under siege. I think that's a little too strong. But what you do see is that there's much more pushback against Amazon across the country, most notably in New York City, where community and labor activists rose up against the de Blasio Cuomo deal to give the richest man in the world $3 billion in tax money to build Amazon in Queens, while at the same time you take your life into your hand riding the New York City subway because you don't know if it's going to catch on fire, break down, and the schools and the neighborhoods that they wanted to build the Amazon headquarters themselves are massively underfunded. So we saw essentially something that almost took on the feel of a kind of community uprising, and Bezos ran out of New York City. It's a small but important victory. Even in the heart of Amazon land, you start to see resistance to their policies. Last spring, we saw an effort by many of the white-collar techs at Amazon's headquarters in Seattle to get a petition going that called for the company to be more transparent and accountable on environmental issues. And since most Amazon white-collar employees own stock and are stockholders, they can actually get resolutions put before the Amazon board of directors, much to the annoyance of Jeff Bezos and the top leaders of Amazon Incorporated. And by the end of the petition drive, they had 6,000 Amazon employees, mostly the white-collar employees, had signed on to this resolution asking for more transparency around environmental issues. Their resolution was, of course, voted down by the board of directors, but nonetheless, it showed that all is not happy in Amazon land. And one of the most, I think, inspiring struggles was the struggle of Somali immigrants in Minnesota who carried out several job actions for the right to pray during work time. It was a small but important victory. Amazon did everything it can to try to disguise it actually as a job action. They tried to sell it as a community relations discussion, but nonetheless, it was a job action that won a significant but important victory, particularly in a country who's known for its terrible Islamophobia right now. So Amazon is a company that I think, you know, over the last 5 years, its public image has been completely transformed. It's a company where you find widespread opposition to its policies, particularly when it comes to tax subsidies and, you know, the revelation that it paid no federal taxes whatsoever in 2018 and 2017, we have seen the possibilities of community and labor action against these policies, and we've begun to see some job actions that have actually won concessions against Amazon on the job. So this is quite a transformation, and at the same time, we should also recognize that Amazon is an incredibly wealthy company. It's incredibly powerful. It seems to be everywhere, doing everything, including owning newspapers, the grocery store. You know, people may or may not like analogies about using octopuses to illustrate a point, but nonetheless, the idea that Amazon has reached deep into every area of the economy and transformed it, I think is undoubtedly true. For us as socialists, as activists, the question that always comes up in all of this stuff is what can we do to actually promote workers' power on the job, trade union organization, something where we can begin to fundamentally shift the relationship between the workers of Amazon and the bosses of Amazon. And so when people ask me, well, you know, how should we pose this as a discussion at socialism, I said, well, how about can we organize Amazon? Because it's very much posed as a question, like, what would it take to organize a behemoth that Amazon has become? We've seen some chinks in its armor. How do we actually defeat the corporate monster? Okay, so I'm going to try to address some of that today, and I want other people's ideas on this, because Amazon is a company that's not just located in one city; it's everywhere, and so forth. So I want to try to go through a couple of things here, I think, to try to maybe provide some deep background and some of the specifics about Amazon and what does that pose as kind of an organizing challenge for us. Well, the first thing I think we need to do is, you know, how did we get here, right? Why is it that, you know, companies like, you know, if you go back 50 years ago, the major, you know, retail outlets, the major transportation companies, you know, the companies that we now sort of ubiquitously call logistics, you know, because logistics is a term that's, you know, applied to everything, right? I mean, people just call, you know, I'll call myself a logistics company because it makes you sound more important, right? But it is true that you go back 50 years ago when the economy was more unionized, it was more localized, workers had more of a say in what was going on, the economy was more regulated, and yet 50 years later, we seem to live in a completely different world. And a lot of the time, that's either just given the quick term of the logistics revolution or neoliberalism. And, you know, what does all this mean? And then how did somebody like Amazon emerge out of this? Well, I think it's important to say that the logistics revolution is not just an interesting sort of tagline or advertising buzzword out of Madison Avenue. It's a real thing. Logistics is still, for most people, though I think it probably less so these days, still has a kind of military ring to it, you know, that logistics is about winning wars and marshaling, you know, the resources of a nation to fight another nation in a major war. And of course, you know, that's an important thing for the 20th century and its impact on civilian logistics, because after all, the 20th century saw two of the greatest world wars in history, you know, World War I and World War II, which had a fundamental impact not just on who the major powers were, but also an impact on how the civilian economy was transformed by this. Now, of course, you know, you go back to the end of World War II, this might be hard for many of the younger comrades to know, but there was no GPS, there were no personal computers, there was no federal highway system. Most of the ports in the United States were relics of the 19th century. There was no barcodes. You know, somehow we managed to have the French and American revolutions defeat the South in the Civil War and have the Bolshevik Revolution, and we did it without the internet. I'm a little facetious there, but I think it's important to kind of say sort of things like that. The world of 50, 60 years ago was very different. And it's the interaction between military logistics and the civilian economy that begin to transform not only transportation and the organization of production and distribution, but it actually kind of changes who are the major players in the national and in the world economy. So this is where we begin to see in the 1960s and 70s the rise of containerization in the ports, which transforms how goods are sent all over the world. We begin to see a move towards the massive deregulation of the national economies. We begin to see a move towards a much more hostile atmosphere for the labor movement. And we also see a major capital investment in revamping the port systems and the global transportation networks. And all of this begins to produce a real radical change, not only where goods are produced, but also the relationship between the producers, the retail industry, and how consumers are finally serviced at the end of the line on this. During this era, this is where you begin to see the emergence of companies like Walmart, for instance, who begin to sort of blur the distinction between the old manufacturing and retail economies. And what I mean by that is, if you go back 50, 60 years ago, the economy was rather predictable. You had people who produced things, you had people who stored them in warehouses, and you had companies that that sold them. And in a way, that's kind of how it's still done, except the players are different. So companies like Walmart begin to have, because they become so big and so well organized, that they begin to actually dominate the manufacturing companies themselves. Throughout the 70s and the 80s, Walmart grows from being a regional company based in a place called Arkansas to then emerging to becoming not only dominating the American economy, but eventually becoming the world's largest private employer. And in some ways, Walmart becomes the model for the logistics corporation, where they begin to blur some of these distinctions between manufacturing and distribution. In the 1990s, this really picks up steam, not only because Walmart sort of has this juggernaut that kind of takes over the retail economy, but you begin to see other retail giants like Home Depot, Target, particularly in the United States, and the emergence of major transportation companies, delivery companies such as UPS and FedEx, who begin to play a kind of major role in the U.S. economy in a way that they were a fairly subordinate part of the American economy in the decades before that. This all leads, particularly with all the new transportation networks, both air, sea, and land, that leads to what we call the creation of new concentrations of production all over North America. Kim Moody, in his book New Terrain, talks about how there are 65 definable logistics clusters that are all connected by major rail, air, land, and ports, where there's the highest concentration of production and distribution throughout the United States. Not surprisingly, the three biggest ones are New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and another place called Alliance, Texas. So if anybody here is from Texas, they'll know that Alliance is a major logistics cluster in the South. This means that in a lot of ways, it's a world that's kind of was transformed. When I was a young socialist, one of the things that we lived through in the 1970s and the 1980s was really kind of the destruction or reorganization of the old industrial economy. They not only closed the steel mills, they blew them up. You know, the old centers of auto production like Detroit and Toledo turned into ghost towns. But in one sense, what the logistics revolution has done is that it's recreated another industrial working class in many places right on top of where the older ones exist. So when you go to the major logistics companies today, Walmart with nearly a million employees, but then you go to companies like United Parcel Service, which has 460,000 global employees, 300,000 of them in the United States, 250,000 of them are members of the Teamsters Union. FedEx has 300,000 employees in the United States. Amazon, which was started in 1994 in Seattle, and of course the company mythology is that it was in Bezos's garage with a door for the first desk, and I'm sure that's probably true, but, you know, it's sort of like, you know, Jesus with the chalice. It sort of becomes, you know, when you want to create a legend, you make it into something else. But a company that has existed for less than 25 years has over 640,000 worldwide employees, most of whom are concentrated in the United States. So what you have with the logistics revolution is not just simply a creation of a new industrial clusters across the country, many of which are right on top of the old industrial centers. So for example, if you go out to Willow Springs on off of Route 55 here in Chicago, you'll see the enormous Chicago Consolidated Area hub of UPS, which has 8,000 people. Well, that was built on top of the old GM Fisher Body plant. And if you go all across the country, you see the same sort of thing. It's not also a surprise that the heavy overlay of military logistics with civilian logistics also continues, because one of the biggest concentrations of logistics workers in the Midwest is out in Joliet, Illinois, at the old Joliet Arsenal, which, among other things, used to make nerve gas to fight in the First World War, and was a munitions supply depot right through the 1980s. So, you know, you can go all over the world and you can see this phenomena, but in the United States, it's pretty starkly clear. Most of the companies like UPS, FedEx, with their enormous workforces, have workforces that are larger than the actual standing armies of most countries. So, you know, UPS has 460,000 worldwide employees. The standing army of the United States right now is 440,000. The British Army's standing army is 80,000 people. FedEx has 300,000 employees. So, you know, what I'm trying to, you know, when people talk about the disappearing working class or the disappearing industrial working class, it's almost, you have to say to people, well, another one has been created, and it actually knocks on your door and delivers to you. In a lot of ways. It's sort of, what I'm trying to encourage people to do is to look at something very differently. Now, Amazon, of course, in some ways, in the same way that, you know, Walmart led the logistics revolution in the 70s and 80s, Amazon has kind of taken off from Walmart, and this is not an accident. According to Edward Stone's book, The Everything Store, apparently Jeff Bezos used to carry around a copy of Sam Walton's autobiography with him, Sam Walton being the founder of Walmart. And he found great inspiration from Walmart's biography about the model company that he wanted. And it seems that the one thing that he took from the Walmart model was to work his people to death. One early founder of Amazon, when they only had one sorting hub in Seattle, expressed some concern to Bezos about, our people pay too much money to park around here, Jeff. Why don't we just get people bus passes? And he said, no, we don't want to do that, because if they have a bus pass, that means they have to catch the last bus home. And if they have cars, it means they can sleep in the cars and then come back to work earlier in the next shift. He never denied that, by the way. I mean, that was publicly, you know. So, and if you go to a Walmart or a Amazon hub, the working conditions, I think, kind of reflect that. But it's also, I think, more important to see that what Bezos has done with the construction of Amazon is he's taken what was given to him by Walmart, that is the idea of using GPS and barcodes and advanced technology to then run a retail system through the internet in a way that Walmart continued to build brick and mortar stores right up until very, very recently, within the last six or seven years. In 2012, Amazon instituted what they called Operation Dragon Boat. Now, if that sounds like something out of a bad Bond movie, I don't think you're mistaken. And that was their plan to create a global shipping network that would include, among other things, a shipping line to bring consumer goods from China to the United States, and a worldwide air network to connect all of their hubs. And by and large, they have implemented that plan. What makes Amazon, of course, different from Walmart is that it's been able to put together both being a retail operation and a transportation network at the same time, which makes it very different from both Walmart and companies like UPS. There are over 250 Amazon facilities across the country right now, which they've all built in the last 6 years, by the way. It is probably a building spree that far surpasses anything that UPS or FedEx did during their go-go days. So for example, it took UPS 90 years to have 150,000 employees. It took Walmart less than 10 years to do that. So the speed of change has been quite dramatic. And with their purchase of Whole Foods, it's given them that brick and mortar presence that they pretty much avoided for a long time. Now for organizing Walmart, of course, this also has created both things that are similar and different from Walmart. People may remember from things that they read about Walmart in the past that the one way that they tried to avoid unionization is they built all of their hubs out in the middle of nowhere, right? So you were in the cornfields here, you were way out there. So union organizers technically, you know, for some reason can't drive. I never really understood the logic behind Walton, you know. But, and I mean, so that's how they view the world, right? I mean, it's not quite right, but, you know, but they would build them in depressed areas where people were glad to have a job. They were far away from the urban cities, which they identified with unions. But the difference, of course, with Amazon is because it wants to be a delivery company that provides things in one, two, or several hour service. They have to build hubs in the cities. So one of the things that I think everybody knows from even just wandering around their own hometowns is that Amazon hubs are not way out in the middle of nowhere. They're literally just within blocks of major neighborhoods. So, you know, here in Chicago, they have an Amazon Prime delivery service on Goose Island, which is 3 minutes from the Loop. They have major delivery hubs all around the city. And then they have major, what they call sortation hubs, regional hubs, all over the place. If you drive up the 90 towards Kenosha, you know, there's a massive Amazon hub there that employs several thousand people. And when I talked to Mark Meinster from Warehouse Workers for Justice, he says that when Walmart built their warehouse there 5 years ago, nobody had built a warehouse for 50 years in Kenosha. So they've built regional centers, but more importantly, they've had to build hubs in the cities, which means that they're far more accessible to community organizing and labor organizing. In fact, Amazon is on such a building spree and a buying spree for delivery trucks that they placed an order for Mercedes-Benz in South Carolina to build them 50,000 delivery vans. So they not only have created a kind of new type of logistics corporation that puts together retail and transportation, they've created now this enormous industrial workforce of warehouse workers and delivery workers who are quite accessible to people who are interested in organizing them. Now, having said that, I think it's also worth noting that organizing in the transportation industry historically in the United States has been both some of the most difficult, and it's also been some of the struggles that have produced some of the greatest political struggles in the history of the United States. So, I mean, when you think about the current generation of workers who are employed by companies like Amazon, and increasingly attempts by Walmart, Target, and others to mimic these things from Amazon, is that these struggles have a potential to actually bring out not just simply struggles over wages and working conditions, but very political struggles. So, you know, just think for a moment about some of the big transport struggles of the past. I mean, things like, you know, the 1877 railroad uprising in the United States, which is probably the closest we've ever come to a workers' revolution in this country, or the great Teamster strikes in Minneapolis in 1934, or more recently, the 1997 UPS strike, which knocked off 2% growth off the US economy and, you know, for at least a short period of time, washed away many of the defeats that had been inflicted on the American working class in the 1980s and the 1990s. At the same time, it's also true that many of the transportation industries are covered by some of the most repressive labor laws in the country. and have been subject to some of the most greatest political repression. So when you also look back at the great struggles of the past, you also have to remember that some of those, the people who led them, have also been subject to the greatest political persecution. So whether you're Eugene Debs with the, you know, the Pullman strike, or Harry Bridges, who led the San Francisco waterfront strike, or Hoffa Sr. when he was the leader of the Teamsters, or Ron Carey, you know, though they may be different people with different politics and different histories, they're also people who suffered incredible persecution from the federal government. When we bring back, I think, the discussion to the practicalities of what it would take to organize in the Amazon today, I think we are starting to have at least the beginnings of the possibility of talking about that type of strategy right now. I began by talking about the various sort of small campaigns in and around Amazon, but I think it's also worth saying that the transformation of I think our discussion around the possibilities of organizing because of the teachers' struggles provide, I think that's kind of why people want to talk about Amazon now, because it's kind of lifted people's horizons about what they think may be possible to do in the labor movement that we haven't done for a long time. Again, when I was talking to Mark Meinster from Warehouse Workers for Justice, they do a lot of great work across the country. I just said, well, what do you think it would take to organize at Amazon? Well, he said, one, I think it would take something big. Okay, well, what do you mean big, you know? And he said, well, I think we need something like something like a UPS-type strike that would kind of raise the expectations of all Amazon workers about a possibly different future. And when he said that, I remember that in the aftermath of the 1997 strike, literally the day after the agreement was signed and the Teamsters won a straight-out victory, that much of the media buzz was about, does that mean that the Teamsters are going to go organize FedEx now? And of course, part of getting rid of Kerry was making sure that the impact of the strike was contained and pushed back there, but it raised expectations. I think it's worth saying right now a couple of things about what it would take. One is, I think it would take something bigger, but I think it would also take, you know, we have to figure out how we lay some groundwork for organizing something as enormous as Amazon, right? With 300,000 warehouse workers and drivers across the country, we can't have a national campaign to do that. There's no unions that are necessarily willing to do something like that right now. But I do think if we look at the past, particularly with the CIO in the 1930s, we should remember that things like, you know, General Motors, which was seen as the most powerful corporation in the world, wasn't organized either by a nationwide strike. It was organized by one strike in one central location, which was in Flint, Michigan. And if we look at a monster like Amazon, or even something like FedEx these days, is that what makes them vulnerable to something like a Flint-type situation is that they are highly dependent on an interconnected delivery system, particularly their air operations. So Amazon's air operations are based out of Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky, and their major sortation centers, I hate that phrase, because I keep feeling like I'm slurring my words when I say it, is their major hubs, I'll use a UPS word on that one, concentrate their workers in several key locations in the Midwest. And I think for socialists and for people who are labor activists, we can't think of organizing Amazon as a whole, but we have to pick the strategic locations in Amazon where we can do systematic political work over the next few years that can lay the groundwork for a campaign in job actions. One of the things that I think is part of that is to transform, particularly in the ideas of for Amazon employees, what a union could be in the United States right now. Unfortunately, my old union, the Teamsters, is not the most inspiring union in the world. I wrote a series of articles for Jacobin where I said if they have the right type of fight at the UPS, that could lay the groundwork for organizing at Amazon. And they fulfilled my expectations by going in and actually paying people, negotiating less money for start pay at UPS than what Bezos pays people to start work at Amazon. So I think that when we talk about what a union could be, particularly to a workforce that Amazon has to draw out of the high unemployment that exists among particularly African-American neighborhoods, where there's a huge turnover rate at Amazon, that, you know, we can talk about unions being something that truly can fight around black liberation, police brutality, anti-immigrant sentiment, because a lot of workers who work at Amazon are immigrant workers. And I think the Somali struggle in Minnesota should provide us with a bigger window and vision about those issues on the job. So I think that when, can we organize the Amazon? Well, you know, well, of course we can. But I think where we begin is something a bit more modest, which is to say that the struggles that have been started, particularly by the teachers, have transformed this atmosphere. But what we want to do, I think, as a new socialist movement and as the beginnings of a new labor movement in this country, is to try to figure out those central locations at a place like Amazon where we can do systematic political work over the next few years to lay the groundwork for what undoubtedly will be at some point a national struggle of Amazon workers to unionize themselves for dignity and justice on the job. So I will end there. Thanks.